Two names you've been hearing a lot lately, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman.
They've become sort of the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of the impeachment inquiries, popping up in odd places.
Odd is the word. The story of the Soviet-born business associates linked to the impeachment inquiry. Also today, new doping allegations could ban Russia from next year's Olympics.
If you compare Russia to the United States, Americans love sports, while Russians love gold medals.
And being first lady comes with a challenging job description. Greet foreign dignitaries, champion a cause, and lose part of your identity.
You are known primarily as somebody else's spouse instead of yourself. That's a strange adjustment to make.
The wife of the president of Iceland shares her story. I'm Marco Werman, all that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. There is plenty of news to go around, some good, some bad. But when a new report on greenhouse gas emissions says in no uncertain terms that their findings are bleak, well, we're going to pay attention to that. The report from the UN out today basically says that 4 years after countries agreed to take action as part of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, we are not trying hard enough at our own peril. The World's Environment editor, Carolyn Beeler, is with me. Carolyn, what are the findings beyond just bleak?
The top line here, Marco, is that world countries are way off target from what they've promised in the Paris Climate Agreement. Even if they met all of their promises to cut carbon, they'd still be hitting about 3 degrees Celsius of global warming, which is way off of the well under 2 degrees that they promised in this agreement. These targets were not that ambitious to begin with, because the idea of the Paris Agreement was to get everyone on board and then grow more and more ambitious. But even so, this new report is pointing out that even these less ambitious targets, many countries are not hitting.
Perhaps it's not too surprising, but it is disappointing and kind of ominous. Is it still possible to meet the Paris Agreement goals?
It is possible, but it's just getting harder and harder the longer we wait. The report had this quote that was really blunt. Countries collectively failed to stop the growth in global greenhouse gas emissions, meaning that deeper and faster cuts are now required. Mm. Now, a stat from that report that really jumped out at me was that if the world had really started cutting carbon back in 2010, we would have had to cut about 3% of global greenhouse gas emissions a year to hit the targets that scientists say we need to by 2030. Now, we have to cut carbon by about 7.5% each year to hit that target within a decade. Now, it's often said that the world needs to put itself on a carbon diet, and I think that analogy is actually helpful here. So if we collectively were a 200-pound person, that would mean losing 15 pounds a year for the next decade.
Wow, 15 pounds per year, that is a big challenge. This report names names, or rather names countries, I guess. Who's meeting the targets that were set out in the Paris Agreement and who is not?
This report focuses on the G20 countries, the richest countries in the world, and really called them out to say they need to do more. It found that the majority of either aren't on track to meet their targets, that's including the U.S. and Canada, or are meeting their targets only because they were not strong enough to begin with, including Russia and Turkey. The only G20 countries that do seem to be on track to meet their targets that seem reasonable are China, the EU, and Mexico.
So the bottom line with this report is that even though every country in the world got together in Paris and said we need to cut emissions, very few countries are actually living up to that.
That's right. And that means that global emissions just continue to rise. In fact, new numbers from the World Meteorological Organization released just yesterday showed that 2018 once again hit a new record high for greenhouse gas emissions. Now, to illustrate this upward rise in CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, we did something that we sometimes do on the show. We put it to music. We sonified this data. Mm. So let's start with what it sounds like to have 300 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. That's a threshold we crossed for the first time ever around the middle of last century. And let's pick up in the mid-1980s when we really started hearing more about climate change. Back in 1984, so the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere was 344 parts per million. And this is right around 1988 when climate scientist James Hansen testified before Congress and raised one of the first really public alarms about climate change. In 1997, when CO2 in the atmosphere was 363 parts per million, world countries signed the Kyoto Protocol to try to get things under control. It failed, and global emissions continued to rise. Skipping ahead a handful of years here. And right around here is 2015, when the Paris Climate Change Agreement was signed, and global carbon emissions passed 400 parts per million in the atmosphere for the first time.
So the UN emissions report is basically saying, get it right, countries, or else. So what kinds of solutions is it proposing?
That's really key, Marco. The big difference between that first music note that we heard representing the mid-80s and today is that now we have a lot of the solutions to climate change at our fingertips. And the second half of this UN report released today focuses on those. Overall, it recommends countries focus on switching over entirely to renewables for electricity generation, incentivizing switching to electric vehicles and using public transport, and working toward zero emissions buildings. And the solutions portion of this report really reiterates the fact that climate change is not technically impossible to fix. It's really a matter of whether the political will be there to fix it.
The World's Environment Correspondent Carolyn Beeler, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
We've all heard about the three amigos.
I'm Lucky Day.
I'm Ned Niederlander.
I'm Dusty Bottoms. So together we're
the Three Amigos.
That's the knucklehead trio of Steve Martin, Chevy Chase, and Martin Short in the 1986 comedy. But now the Three Amigos is also synonymous with three U.S. diplomats at the center of U.S. policy toward Ukraine. Those amigos are Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland, Energy Secretary Rick Perry, and former Special Envoy Kurt Volker. There's also a sequel here, if I may. This time, it's two amigos who've emerged as central to the impeachment story, Soviet-born business associates Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. The men were apprehended at Dulles Airport in October with one-way tickets to Vienna. I asked author Garrett Graff what we've been learning about the two men in recent days.
They've become sort of the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of the impeachment inquiries, popping up in odd places and serving as key go-betweens between Rudy Giuliani, some of these Ukrainian oligarchs, and even appearing to do some business with President Trump or on behalf of President Trump. Lev Parnas is appearing to be willing to cooperate with House investigators and has turned over some set of audio and potentially video recordings to the committee, although he has also in other places asserted his Fifth Amendment privilege to avoid testifying about some of those campaign finance questions, whereas Igor Fruman is not cooperating with Congress and the investigation. So it's clear that Parnas sees an opportunity to potentially help get himself out of the hot water that he's in with federal prosecutors by cooperating with House investigators.
So in the past few days, Parnas is also making life more difficult for Representative Devin Nunes, the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee. What has Parnas alleged?
So one of the things that has come out in the last couple of days that has added to the circus-like atmosphere of these impeachment hearings is the stunning news that Devin Nunes, the man who has been leading the president's defense as ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, himself has actually been out in Europe investigating Joe Biden's ties in Ukraine and Hunter Biden's business ties in Ukraine, and that Nunes has been trying to dig up dirt alongside some of these efforts that we have seen from folks like the sort of deposed Ukrainian prosecutor Viktor Shurkin.
So this week, Fox News anchor Maria Bartiromo asked Nunes about that trip.
Bottom line, were you in Vienna with Shokin?
Yeah, so look, Maria, I really want to answer all of these questions, and I promise you I absolutely will come back on the show and answer these questions.
Garrett Graff, wouldn't it be pretty easy to establish whether Parnas' claim that Nunes went to Vienna is true?
Yes, and in fact, there's very clear evidence that at least aspects of it are true, that Devin Nunes has filed for taxpayer reimbursement of some of these trips, including at least $14,000 that he charged for a four-day trip that would appear to meet the parameters of what is being alleged.
So basically, the allegation is that Devin Nunes was also trying to dig up dirt on the Bidens.
Yes. And to put it a little bit more succinctly, that Devin Nunes, the leading defender of the president in Congress in these impeachment hearings, is himself a co-conspirator in the underlying efforts.
Garrett Graff is the author of The Threat Matrix Inside Robert Mueller's FBI and the War on Global Terror. Thank you very much, Garrett.
Always a pleasure.
Presidents are not kings. Those words from a federal judge yesterday, ruling against the Trump administration's claim of absolute immunity. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson ruled that White House counsel Don McGahn must testify in the impeachment inquiry. The judge said powers must be split between the branches of government to prevent tyranny. This got us thinking, how far do the rights of kings and queens extend today? The world's history guy Chris Wolfe dug into this one.
Everybody loves the pomp and ceremony around the royals. This is the British coronation anthem written by Handel for George II almost 300 years ago, and still one of my favorite pieces of music. Princes and princesses fill the stories we tell our children. Here's the situation with royal families across the globe today. Emperor Naruhito of Japan is the newest monarch, acceding just last month. He's a member of one of just 26 royal families around the world still on the job. Technically, the Pope is also the monarch of the Vatican, while Malaysia has a rotating monarchy shared among the various sultans of Malaysia's member states. So that's 28. Then there are 15 other countries besides the UK that share Queen Elizabeth as their head of state. So in all, about one in five members of the United Nations has a monarch. But the main thing to note about monarchies in 2019 is that there's a big difference between, say, Sweden and Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, royals have demonstrated recently that they are above the law.
A United Nations report says the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia should be investigated over the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The kingdom has denied
accusations. Saudi Arabia is one of just five of the world's remaining monarchies that are considered absolute. Most other kingdoms have limits. These could be legislative or judicial balances, you know, that separation of powers thing. And usually this is a result of the political need of a monarch for money and legitimacy. Or like in HBO's Game of Thrones, the need to buy off potential rivals.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
But in the real world, bargains are struck between the masses and their monarchs. The most famous of these bargains, at least in the Anglo-Saxon world, is the Magna Carta, when King John of England conceded rights and privileges to his nobles. The French 18th century philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau dignified these bargains with the term social contract. When a king or queen violates that contract, the people have a right to overthrow them.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death!
An early Hollywood rendition of Patrick Henry's rhetoric to the Virginia Assembly in 1775. The United States arose in response to demands from a monarch, demands that were judged to be a breach of that contract between the king and his people. As we all know, the British king, George III, was thrown out, and the daring American experiment began. History up to that point showed that republics usually descend into tyrannies. The French Revolution ended with Napoleon declaring himself emperor. So when a US district judge says President Trump is claiming the powers of a king, that's a strong statement. But she's not alone. Some constitutional scholars have asserted that the executive privileges claimed by Trump are now greater than any claimed by King George III of England. For the world, I'm Chris Wolfe.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Russia is again under fire for its sportsmanship, or rather its apparent lack of sportsmanship. World Anti-Doping Agency investigators found positive drug tests were deleted and that data from a Moscow lab was incomplete. The agency is now recommending that Russia be banned from hosting major sporting events for the next 4 years and that the Russian flag cannot be flown at any major sporting events during that time. That would mean saying goodbye to the Tokyo Summer Olympics next year. I asked Russian-American sports writer Slava Malamud what he thinks about this.
I just scanned some Russian sports media, and one of the headlines struck me. It's actually the newspaper I used to work for, Sport Express, and their headline is, "We should have gotten better hackers." I mean, the idea, and this has always been the case, the idea is that it's not bad to cheat as long as you don't get caught. And if you do get caught, you need to do all in your power, all that's in your power in order to lessen the punishment or in order to make sure you still get away with it. Thing is, sports in Russia is never just sports. And Russians don't really care that much about sports per se. They care about gold medals, in as much as gold medals bring quote-unquote glory to the motherland. This is what sports has always been about, international sports at least. It's always been about state propaganda. It's always been about prestige of the country and of the ruling regime. And there's no motivation for Vladimir Putin or for anyone else who is in power to play by the rules, because the payoff is for gold medals is an enormous propaganda value, whereas playing by the rules means you will invariably lose to countries with a better economy. And
but that attitude that you quoted from that newspaper, that's just crazy. You address cheating with more cheating. I mean,
are you
saying Russians, at least in the political sphere, are predisposed to cheating?
In the sports sphere, absolutely. Because sports is a part of foreign policy, and it's the ends justify the means. And the basic argument they're making is, well, this is the fault of the hackers who could not clean up their tracks very well, so why should our athletes suffer? I mean, the question is, why did the hackers have to alter the documents in the first place? Well, that never arises because, again, and there's underlying justifications. They'll go and say, hey, you know, everybody cheats. We're just the ones who people key on because we are Russia and everybody wants to get rid of us because they hate us. But again, these are the excuses they make. But the actual position is it doesn't matter how we win as long as we win.
So a final decision will be made by WADA on December 9th. I mean, we know doping in sports has been a problem in Russia for years. This has got to be a huge blow for Russian athletes who do play by the rules, don't you think?
Yes, it is. But the fact is, I mean, they're part of a system. Unfortunately, sports in Russia, there are some athletes who exist outside of the system, and they're the ones who actually do get to compete. But the great majority, they have to be part of that system, of the state-run system. And you know, when you dance with the devil type of situation, because they all know that the system doesn't really value them, and it doesn't value the rules and doesn't value the norms. And a lot of them don't have any choice. They have to be a part of it in order to compete. Some do. But, I mean, this is a situation that's probably not going to change unless the government in Russia changes and changes for the better, which, of course, has not really been historically the case. I mean, everything is tied up in that. I mean, when sports is part of government and is part of the state-run propaganda and it has its own goals in mind, you kind of have to suffer the consequences of whatever actions that the government takes. If you compare Russia to the United States, Americans love sports while Russians love gold medals. Mm. And that's the biggest difference to me.
Slava Malamud, a Russian-American sports writer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is an astounding number. More than 4 million Venezuelans have fled their country's economic and political crisis in the past 5 years. Most cross the border into neighboring countries like Colombia, but some of President Nicolas Maduro's most powerful opponents have regrouped on the other side of the Atlantic.
I live with my wife and two of our sons in Madrid.
This Venezuelan exile runs one of his country's last remaining independent newspapers from his apartment in the Spanish capital. Jennifer Omani recently paid him a visit.
The editor of Venezuela's El Nacional newspaper is fielding phone calls and catching up on his publication's podcast.
From here, I can manage the lines of editorial lines. It's very fast. I mean, you have internet, you have all this type of new communication.
Miguel Enrique Otero sends out the day's top stories to his 5,000 WhatsApp subscribers and 1.8 million Twitter followers right from his couch in Madrid.
I think Madrid is the best city to live outside Caracas, of course, my city.
Otero has lived in Spain since May 2015. That's when El Nacional republished a story accusing a senior member of President Nicolas Maduro's government of narco-trafficking, and the official filed a defamation suit.
The judge took measures against everybody, and at that moment I was in Israel, so I just stayed outside Venezuela. I didn't go back.
With an arrest warrant hanging over him, Otero fled to Spain with his family. They now live in a duplex apartment in a chic neighborhood in Madrid. He's well aware that his existence is a world away from the life of many Venezuelans who've escaped across the border to Colombia or Brazil.
Poor people go through Colombia. They don't have a passport. They don't have So most of the people that come to Spain are middle class.
There are now about 320,000 Venezuelans in Spain. Around 90,000 live in Madrid. They include some of Venezuela's most powerful opposition figures. When Otero invites me to lunch, the former Venezuelan representative to the UN, Diego Arria, is visiting from New York. He's spearheading efforts to get Venezuela kicked off the UN Human Rights Council. Otero is in daily contact with Venezuelan opposition figures fighting to push Maduro out of office.
Venezuela is a country kidnapped by a bunch of gangsters, of robbers, of narcotraffic. I mean, it's not like a normal dictatorship.
Venezuela's government has bought up almost all the country's major newspapers. Otero refused an offer for El Nacional, which was founded by his grandfather. The government responded by cutting off the supply of newsprint. In December 2018, El Nacional became an online-only publication as the printing presses fell silent for the first time in 75 years. But it hasn't changed Otero's editorial stance.
We publish everything.
He says the authorities don't censor them before publication.
They act after. I mean, you can publish whatever you want, and they will penalize you afterwards.
That means lawsuits, attacks on the premises, and targeting by pro-government gangs. Many of his reporters have fled Venezuela for their lives. Otero still has children in Venezuela. One is an actress, another a businessman.
And the other one is the manager of the newspaper. Has to be there.
Even though Miguel knows his son could at any moment join the hundreds of critics of the regime in jail.
We are worried about everyone in Venezuela. Right now there are 300 political prisoners. A lot of students, I know a lot of them.
Otero knows he too would be thrown in jail the second he lands on Venezuelan soil. He admits no one can predict what will happen in Venezuela, but he's hoping for the day when a popular revolution, or the military, oust Maduro. Until that happens, he flicks through the headlines on his iPad, waiting. For The World, Jennifer Omani, Madrid.
You're with The World. Yogi Berra once said, "Nobody goes there anymore, it's too crowded." He could have been talking about two of Japan's most revered sushi restaurants.
A restaurant becomes extremely popular and they reach the stage where they tend to give reservations to recurring regular customers.
No availability means no more top ratings. Demoted for popularity, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. This next story is not uplifting, like so much of the news these days. But with this one, if you are in the car with little ones right now, you might want to lower the volume for the next 5 minutes. In Argentina, two Roman Catholic priests have been sentenced each to more than 40 years in prison for sexually abusing children, deaf children. The two priests, as well as a gardener, were found guilty of raping and abusing more than 20 boys and girls at a church school. It went on for a dozen years until 2016. One of the priests had been accused of similar offenses in Italy in the 1970s, but was never charged. Veronica Smink is a reporter with BBC Mundo. She's been following the story and joins us now from her base in Buenos Aires. So what are the details of this case, Veronica?
Well, this is a truly horrific case. As you mentioned, these were children that they went to a special institute for the deaf, the Provolo Institute. It had its first institute in Verona, Italy. It transpired that during the 60s and 70s, many children there were abused. Unfortunately, one of the priests who worked there, Nicola Corradi, was then sent to Argentina, where he directed two institutes, one in the province of Buenos Aires and another one in the province of Mendoza. This case was about the abuses in Mendoza, but the Argentine authorities are also investigating abuses in the other institute in a place called La Plata. One of the terrible things, we're not only talking about, you know, children who were abused. Also, we're talking about deaf children who, because of their disability, could not tell their parents what was happening. Some of them, the system didn't allow for sign language, so the smaller children could not communicate at all.
Yeah, I got to say, after decades of encountering terrible Catholic abuse stories, this one is especially stunning. How are the families of the victims reacting to the sentencing?
they're relieved. They're relieved that finally not only that the priest got a very heavy sentence of over 40 years, but also that this case has come to light. For many, many years, they were not heard. So for them, it's just a huge relief that this case has finally come to an end with these sentences. And this is just the first of the trials. There's going to be another trial, to judge two nuns who also face charges of aiding the abusers. And there's still the investigation in the other institute in La Plata, which this Italian priest started when he came over to Argentina.
So the fact that one of the convicted, 83-year-old Nicola Corradi, had been accused of similar offenses in Italy in the 70s but never charged, I mean, this is a frequent problem in the Catholic Church, not prosecuting the perpetrators or the suspects, but just moving them to another parish, sometimes on the other side of the world. Is that being discussed in Argentina, and what is being demanded of the Church right now there?
Absolutely. They say that, you know, this case could have been avoided entirely, that Nicola Corradi was sent to Argentina knowing that he was a pedophile, something that the Church has denied. But also, in this case, it's particularly bad for the Vatican, because the victims of the Italian Institute actually had a meeting with Pope Francis and warned him, gave him a letter with the names of the perpetrators. This was 5 years ago. So at the very least, they could have started an investigation 5 years ago, is what many of the families here said. At the very least, they should have checked to see what was happening, but nothing was done until 1 year after the institute was closed. So people here are very, very disappointed. And things like these definitely are part of the reason why many people are distancing themselves from the Church.
Generally, what's been the trend toward embracing Catholicism in Argentina? Are Argentines more or less religious than, say, 10 years ago?
A recent survey actually showed that the number of Catholics has gone down. There are more evangelical people and also more people who just, don't believe in any religion.
Pope Francis, of course, is from Argentina. Does that play into this at all in terms of how people there feel toward the Church and these revelations?
I think it makes people even more disappointed. The fact that this was happening in his own home country, and yet he did nothing about it. The fact that he was warned personally, that he held a letter with the names of priests who were accused of being pedophiles, and the Vatican, as has happened many times before, did nothing. I think people are very, very disappointed about that here.
My colleague Veronica Smink with BBC Mundo in Buenos Aires. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Eliza Reed will be the first to tell you that she has an eclectic mix of jobs. She's a writer, also a co-founder of the annual Iceland Writers Retreat. And, oh yeah, she's also the First Lady of Iceland. Reed has been outspoken about what she calls outdated assumptions and expectations that come with the role. She even wrote an op-ed recently in the New York Times about that. Iceland's First Lady, Eliza Reed, came by our studio in Boston. You wrote this op-ed earlier this fall where you were pretty frank in saying the position of First Lady is an incredibly weird job. What is the weirdest part about it?
Getting used to the fact that you are known primarily as somebody else's spouse instead of yourself. That's a strange adjustment to make. And it's the fact that this job is really undefined. I mean, it's not even a job. I wasn't elected to a position and I don't have a salary or staff or anything. But there's also certain expectations that I accompany my husband on certain trips or greet foreign dignitaries and things like that. And I think, I'm in this position. I want to be active. I think we need to be hearing women's voices more these days. And so that's the way that I kind of confound expectations about being maybe the female spouse of a head of state, is saying, I'm married to this person, this great guy who's a president, but I also have my own opinion and voice.
So you're a writer, as I said. You run this writer's retreat in Iceland. Have you been kind of coaxed into doing other kind of First Lady mission stuff? Do you have a special First
Sure.
Lady cause?
Right.
Or do you reject that?
I firmly believe that that is somebody's choice. So I do a lot of things and I try to be very active, but I also see it very much as my choice to do so. So the areas that I work on a lot are promoting of literature and literacy, maybe because of this background that I have. Mm. Also to do with gender equality, which really interests me. And Iceland is a global leader in gender equality. I'm also an immigrant to Iceland. I grew up in Canada. And so immigrant issues, multiculturalism are important to me, and issues like entrepreneurship and innovation. And I try to promote that sort of dimension of Iceland as well.
There is this pretty incredible line in your op-ed: "I am not my husband's handbag to be snatched as he runs out the door and displayed silently by his side during public appearances." Do you feel like that's happened to you? And
on occasion, yeah. I think what happens is, again, it's that assumption that my husband would agree to attend a function, and therefore the assumption was that I would just be with him, as if I didn't have to be invited separately. I almost refer to it in the article as sort of the stifling of my identity by 1,000 paper cuts. I mean, I appreciate that I'm in an incredibly privileged position and I enjoy it very much. So I don't want to give the impression that I'm complaining, but I feel that it's very important to come forward and show that women, especially, they're not accessories to their spouses.
So what do you have to do to change this? How do you get to a point where a first lady or a first man is simply the spouse of the leader and they have a job too and they have a life?
The choice to use the platform should be up to him or her. And then otherwise, if there's going to be some sort of a defined position that someone has to do, then people have to look at that in terms of elections and salaries and all that other sort of thing.
You were, as you said, born and raised in Canada. How did you meet your husband?
But we were in graduate school together. We studied in the United Kingdom, but we first kind of met during a fundraiser for the rowing crew. He was on the rowing crew and I was too. And he had to draw a name out of a cup to take a person on a date, but I stuffed the cup with my name. So it wasn't
like you
very
put
democratic.
A dozen.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think probably mine was the only name there.
Very clever.
Yeah.
And you touched on this earlier. What's your perspective of being a Canadian immigrant as well as a figurehead in Iceland?
It's important to me in Iceland, because people know that I'm an immigrant, to use my voice even more because I speak Icelandic with an accent. I speak it imperfectly. And in a country where immigration is a relatively new phenomenon or larger immigration, I also think it's very important that people see that just because I have an accent doesn't mean I shouldn't talk and doesn't mean I should only talk about immigrant issues, quote unquote.
Just on a day-to-day basis, what is your life like? I mean, are you followed around by security? Do you have, like, is there an Icelandic White House?
There is an official presidential residence, that's right. A little less security than I think people in the States might be used to. It's great, actually, because every day is different. You know, some days are really busy. There's speeches, there's events, there's attending things. Some days you're traveling within Iceland or abroad. Some days are what I like to call no makeup days, when I'm just working at home on my computer. That's one of the things that I feel so privileged by and that I enjoy so much, is it's so diverse. And we have such an opportunity to meet so many people. And I'm so grateful, you know, especially in Iceland, we travel around and there's so many people doing so many things for the country. It's a really privileged opportunity to be able to get to know these people and what they're doing.
Eliza Reid is the First Lady of Iceland. Thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bolivia could be heading for new elections this spring. President Evo Morales resigned 2 weeks ago. He's now in exile in Mexico. It's a rocky time for Bolivia, but not the first difficulties the country has faced in recent times. Bolivia is also working through the legacy of a previous president and allegations of human rights abuses. Those allegations are finally being heard in a courtroom here in the United States. The World's Ilana Gordon reports on the Bolivian couple at the center of it all.
Etelvina Ramos Mamani recently woke up in the middle of the night from a terrible dream. In it, her 8-year-old daughter, Marlene, appeared. She liked books. She was always helpful around the house.
Marlene is muy cariñoso, muy amable.
This dream is difficult for Etelvina to talk about. We spoke in Boston after she met with lawyers from Harvard's International Human Rights Law Clinic. Etelvina says the painful memories still consume her. It's what motivated her and her husband, Eloy Rojas Mamani, to board a plane from their home in Bolivia to the United States.
It's muy doloroso, porque hay veces no queremos saber, pero por obligación recordamos.
Eloy sits next to Etelvina. He says it hurts to remember what happened, but the couple feels obligated. Their journey began years earlier in Bolivia's rural indigenous highlands. Etelvina talks about life there, switching to the Aymara language. She cared for livestock and worked the fields. They started a family. Then in 2003, Bolivia was in turmoil. There were protests and strikes against the government's economic policies, especially a proposal to export natural gas that they said exploited their resources. The president at the time, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, responded to the protests by sending in the military, That included where Eloy and Altavino lived.
Después de las once aparece una caravana.
Eloy says he ran into the forest to hide. He believed that men were being targeted. In the end, he says, government forces killed more than 60 people throughout Bolivia during the crackdown. The dead included the Mamani's young daughter, Marlene. She was shot dead through the bedroom window of their home. Etelvina says she witnessed it all. It haunts her.
Muy mal siempre me ha sentido.
After the deaths, Etelvina, Eloy, and others in their town marched to Bolivia's capital, La Paz. They called for the resignation of President Sánchez de Lozada because of the civilian deaths.
Todo el departamento de La Paz.
Eloy remembers seeing the anti-government protests spread. Lozada and his Minister of Defense, José Carlos Sánchez Berzaín, left office and went to the United States, where they still live today. But then the Bolivian government waived their immunity. The U.S. State Department accepted that waiver, and it paved the way for something unusual. It let Eloy and Altavina Mamani sue Bolivia's former president and defense minister in the United States. Eloy says if they win, good. If they don't, fine, but they have to take the risk. Which brings us to a courtroom in Miami last Tuesday, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Mamani versus Lozada.
The Mamanis, the ex-president and minister of defense, all sat in the same room. It's a rare case involving a living ex-head of state.
These deaths are a result of essentially widespread killings by soldiers who were ordered to shoot at anything that moves.
A pro bono lawyer for the Mamanis, James Tice, argued that the president and defense minister oversaw the violence against the civilians.
They were even ordered to shoot at unarmed civilians below the belt.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Raber for the
Stephen Raber, the lawyer for the former Bolivian president, pushed back.
The facts alleged in the original complaint did not meet the test for extrajudicial killing.
Raber argued the killings happened during a chaotic time in Bolivia, which the president and his defense minister were trying to manage.
Ordering the mobilization of a joint police force in a military operation is not an extrajudicial killing. Authorizing the use of necessary force to reestablish public order.
It's been a long, messy case, and it's unclear when the appeals court will reach a decision. But Eloy and Altavina will now wait in Bolivia, returning to a country that once again is in turmoil. After years in power, President Evo Morales resigned after voter fraud allegations. More than 24 people have died in clashes since.
In Bolivia, el mismo raíz que está pasando.
Eloy says the traumas of the past are connected to the unrest of the present day. He says he'll keep pursuing this case. Justice, he says, means breaking a vicious cycle of governments killing its own civilians and sending a message around the world that it won't be tolerated.
Nosotros de cansar no nos podemos cansar.
We won't tire, he says. We won't rest. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
One of the world's great sushi chefs is getting a demotion. Jiro Ono has been declared a national treasure in Japan. His tiny restaurant in a Tokyo subway station is the stuff of legend. For years, Tsukuyabashi Jiro had three coveted Michelin stars. This year, it's not even included in the guide. Another famous Tokyo restaurant, Sushi Saito, also lost its Michelin status. That's because the two restaurants no longer accept general reservations. Andy Haler is a restaurant critic based in London. Have you ever heard of this kind of thing before, where Michelin stars get yanked because it's so hard to get a seat in the restaurant?
Well, it's unusual for sure, but in Japan, that does happen in some cases where a restaurant becomes extremely popular and they reach the stage where they tend to give reservations to recurring regular customers. So when the customer's already in the restaurant, they'll say, okay, would you like to make another reservation? And if that happens enough, and if essentially everybody takes up the recurring reservations, then clearly there's virtually no tables left for the public. There are quite a few restaurants like that in Japan, and not necessarily sort of ultra famous either. I mean, I went to one of these private places about 2 years ago that was actually doing sort of chicken skewers, you know, so it wasn't sort of fancy food, but it was kind of populated with lots of company CEOs and politicians and so on.
Yeah, so what would lead a restaurant to change to a private club? Aren't there commercial and even reputational risks?
Well, I think it's simply that they just got too many customers. They have to maintain staff manning a reservation line, which essentially is pointless because there are no reservations. so in the end, people just get frustrated because they can never get through. And if they do get through, they can't get a table.
It makes me wonder how much the chefs at Jiro and Saito, whether they're disappointed about being excluded from this year's Michelin Guide or whether restaurants generally are caring less about the Michelin stars.
That's hard for me to say. I mean, I think Michelin definitely has some reputational impact in Japan. I just don't think it has quite the kind of impact that it does in Europe amongst chefs. In Japan, you would look at a guy called Tabalog, which is the main online kind of restaurant sort of voting type of site. I would say that is, to be honest, more looked at in Tabalog. Sushi Saito until extremely recently was ranked number one for sushi in not just Tokyo, actually, but the whole of Japan. Though Jiro has never been rated very highly, in fact, in those guys. So it's currently standing at the 66th.
Oh, interesting. Well, a lot of people call Jiro the best sushi restaurant in the world. Do you agree with them? I know you've been there.
I entirely disagree with that assessment. I had a really quite disappointing meal there and a particularly pretty rude service experience as well. Personally, I don't rate it at all. I mean, I think it's an extraordinarily ordinary sushi restaurant with over-vinegared rice and, sort of ordinary kind of product.
Right. So give us a scoop, Andy. I mean, you've been to Japan over a dozen times. Where would you go in Tokyo for the best sushi?
Well, the number one ranked one right now is Sugita, which was terrific. I was there a few months ago and that was lovely. That amusingly only has one star in Michelin, which is quite hard to understand. And the other place that I really rank is Sushi Arai, A-R-A-I. And that's absolutely fabulous. Again, unfortunately, Sugita and Arai are very, very hard to get into. And the general standard of sushi in Tokyo is very high, even from sort of not especially highly rated places there. It's still much higher than it's, you're going to encounter at random in, in London or New York or Boston or somewhere.
That was Andy Haler. He's a restaurant critic based in London. Is Korea's biggest boy band breaking up? Inquiring minds want to know. Here's the world's Amanda McGowan.
The biggest Korean pop, or K-pop, act on the planet is BTS. They've played shows all over the world and have topped the U.S. Billboard charts. You've probably heard their recent mega hit, Boy With Love. Fans of BTS call themselves the ARMY.
Thank you, ARMY!
That's the band thanking fans ahead of their first UK show. Now that name, ARMY, it's a little ironic. That's because this week, South Korea's defense ministry announced the members of BTS will have to complete compulsory military service. In South Korea, all able-bodied men must serve for around 2 years. It's a legacy of the Korean War. And BTS? Well, the group includes 7 able-bodied men. For a while, the question of whether BTS would have to report for duty was up in the air. The state awards some exemptions to people who raise the national profile, mostly in sports or in classical music. But not this time, said Lee Nam-woo, an official with the defense ministry.
Based on public consensus, there have been some requests to expand an exemption review to pop artists who have contributed a lot to the country's reputation. Considering the overall trend of reducing military exemption reviews, as well as the government's stance to uphold justice and fairness for military service obligations, the exemption review has been denied.
Some people argue stars shouldn't be taken out of the limelight at their peak. And this is not a uniquely Korean phenomenon. Elvis was drafted into the army in 1958 and served overseas in Germany at the height of his fame. In South Korea, there's plenty of recent examples of this. The singer Rain completed his service in 2013. And you may remember the singer Psy. Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Psy even had to repeat his service after being accused of neglecting his duties. As for BTS, well, they've been expecting this. Group member Jin had this to say in an interview with CBS News earlier this year.
As a Korean, it's natural, Jin said, and someday when duty calls, we'll be ready to respond and do our best.
As of now, it's unclear when the band members will serve and what it will mean for the supergroup's future. For The World, I'm Amanda McGowan. I can make it right. All right.
we go out with a dose of K-pop today. Make It Right by BTS. That'll soon be Make It Right, Sir. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.